Good morning. My name is Teresa. I'm going to read the sermon passage today from Mark 6, 45 to 52. Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up to the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded. For they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened.
Good morning. My name is Brown Peterson. I'm the Director of Student Ministry and Assistant Pastor here at Trinity, and it's great to be with you all. On a personal plug, if you are new to Trinity and you have middle or high school students and you would like to know more about our student ministry, I would love to talk to you, so you can talk to me after this or email me, brown@trinitylakeland.org, and would love to talk about how to get your students plugged into what we do. If you are new or visiting, we have been going through a series in the Gospel of Mark this fall. And so up to this point, a lot has been happening. And especially for the disciples as they're watching, but Jesus has done a lot of miracles. He's healed people. He brought someone back from the dead. In a previous story, he calmed another storm. And so a lot has been happening. Last week, we saw the famous miracle of Jesus feeding 5,000 with what Tim called a happy meal of 5 loaves and 2 little fish. And so the disciples have a front row seat to this guy that's shocking the world. And Jesus' popularity is just building and building, and more people are following him because they are intrigued by him. But for us, as we hear these stories and we read these amazing things in the Gospel of Mark, it's easy for us to bring some judgment to the disciples. Because we read our bounded Bible with these stories, and we think, if you're a Christian, there's clear evidence why Jesus is worthy of your trust, why you should follow him. Disciples, what are you doing? Why are you guys being so dumb? Look how great he is. But for the disciples, they are just confused. No one has ever spoken like Jesus. No one has ever had authority over the natural world. No one has ever performed miracles. And so they cannot figure out who he is. And so in our text today, we're just right in the middle of their baffling confusion about who Jesus is. I don't know what kind of student you were in high school, or maybe this fits with your current job, but oftentimes we have to be part of group projects. And it's funny, when group projects happen, you can see people take different roles. Some of you are what we call the coasters, okay? You knew you brought nothing to the table. No one expected you to bring anything to the table. You were happy to be there. And so whether the grade was a D or an A, you were there. You were good. Some of you, you're the garbage men. You were hardworking, team player, did anything we asked you to do, but you were not going to drive the ship. You weren't going to make any big decisions on where this thing was going, but you were going to work for the team. Some of you were the bulldozers. You asserted leadership right away, whether you knew what you should do or not, and you were going to make sure others followed you. And so we can think about what kind of person we are, but the holy team, the greatest of all the teams, was when you were assigned with the person who was the expert leader, because they were the smartest, they knew what they were doing, and so it'd be easy to submit to them. And so for me, when I think about group projects or different things I've had to work with teams, or if you just think about your life situations, often we are exposed in different ways of what we know and what we don't know, what we can do, what we can't do, what we believe and what we do not believe. And the Bible, and the big story, it's trying to communicate something so simple, and it's for us to constantly live in the light of the perpetual presence of God. The Bible wants you to come to this conclusion that you are always, at every second of every moment of your life, whatever you are in God's presence. Always. And the Bible is trying to drive that home to us. And so you and I, we can live often ignoring that, thinking everything is on our shoulders, being exposed in that way. And when we work from that point of view, we are often left exhausted, confused, tired, angry. And so we can continue to do that, or what the gospel, what our passage today is calling us to, is we can live with a hope and joy because he is there and he is near. Our passage this morning will be a gift, I think, in exposing us, because Jesus is often not the God we expect, and he does not lead in the way we assume. And more, as we follow the Lord, it is simple what he wants for us, and it's to know him. Not know him intellectually like you would know a president if you read a biography, but to know him intimately, relationally, that you know him. You crave to be with him. You feel empty if you feel like he's far. It's that kind of knowledge. And God is so good that he will use anything, send us into anything, so we come to that needy realization that we are desperate for him. Always and every day, we are desperate for him. So we are going to grow in the awareness of our need for him, which will build a life of thankfulness and love. If you're following along in the worship folder, there's 3 points this morning. The first is being sent by Jesus. He sends us out each day to work and to love in different ways so that we will know him. And that know of intimacy, we would know him. Second is when we work without Jesus. Often our eyes are not fixated on him. We ignore him. We don't think about him. We just keep our eyes low on the ground with what we are doing and how that arrogance often leaves us terrified and confused and lost. And lastly, the hope we have is having Jesus. And if we actually believe Jesus is who he says he is, then he has brought us close when we were far. He has gathered us when we were scattered. And so it brings about a real confidence and joy in our life. So our first point this morning, being sent by Jesus. The context of the scene matters. Remember, Jesus' popularity is growing. More and more people are following him. He's becoming a big deal. And some people are following him for good motives and some for poor. But all these different people are trying to figure out who he is, and his disciples are right there. And so last week, him feeding 5,000 with almost nothing is just building upon the legend. More and more people are going to be like, who is this guy? And especially the disciples, as they have a front row seat to watching this. They are rolling around with a guy who is shocking everyone, including themselves. But before we read our verse in verse 45, other context helps. So when this story is talked about in John, right after the feeding of the 5,000, it says this in John 6:15. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So Jesus does this amazing miracle. People are fed and satisfied. His disciples just watch something amazing, and he can see how they want to take him and make him the king now. It makes sense. If Jesus has that kind of power, then no army could stand up against him. And the Jewish people think they have found their liberation from the Roman Empire. And so we have to think, how do the disciples often try to solve their problems? You know, with the feeding of the 5,000, what was their solution to feeding people? It was money. They wanted to count their money. When Jesus was on his way to heal Jairus' daughter, what was the solution to getting there? Time, quick time. When the woman who had been bleeding for 12 years wanted to stop and slow Jesus down and interrupt him. But they thought it was time that was the solution to their problem. And so their answer to oppression was their answer to their Roman oppression was Jesus. It was power. And Jesus can smell this in the air. And so let's see what he does in verse 45. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat. Jesus is not running, you know, an idea. Hey guys, you want to go out on a boat? He made them. The language here is forceful. Get in the boat. Get out in the water. It's your mom or dad yelling at you to get this chore done. It's a boss telling you to go solve or fix this or change this. It is aggressive. Jesus wants his disciples, get out on the water. And so he makes them. He is managing his staff amongst all these thousands of people. He's managing his people, and he wants them to get out on the boat and get out into the water. And you can kind of understand the disciples' hesitation, because last time they were in a boat, they almost died, and these are like expert sailors. So they're like, Jesus, you know, last time we were, you know, in the boat with you, it wasn't well, we don't want to go. And he says, get out in the water, go. And so he makes them go. And what does Jesus do at that time? He dismisses the crowd, and then he goes to a mountain to pray. Jesus does this miracle, and he wants to be with his Father alone, praying. And he sends out the disciples. He dismisses the crowd. And so a question has to be asked, why would Jesus send them out in this way? Something amazing just happened. Why would he do this? Why is he acting like this? And it's because the disciples do not understand. They don't understand what Jesus is about. They don't understand the mission. They don't understand who God is. They don't understand that God is staring at them in the person of Jesus. They don't get it. And so he's trying to protect their hearts from the selfish gain they're being enticed by, and he has to get them out. And how does he accomplish this? Verse 48, and he saw they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. He sends them out, and now it's opposition. It's storm. It's wind going against them. He sends them out into hardship, and they were exhausted from working the whole night. To take a step back a little bit, when we think about the biblical narrative as a whole, God sends his favorite people into hardship all the time. I think you and I often, we bring our, you know, fluffy imagination that God is only good when there's peace and prosperity in our life. But that is not what you would find in the Bible. Everything good and perfect is from his hand. Anything you do enjoy is from him. It is a gift out of his love for you. But if what he is trying to do is to get our hearts anchored on who he is, he can use the gritty everyday of life, hardship, to draw us into that conclusion of our weakness and frailty and his greatness and our need for him. And so he sends us out in the hopes that when difficulty comes, we'll be like the psalmist in Psalm 121, where I lift my eyes to the hills, where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of the heaven and earth. When you think in the Old Testament, Abraham, he tells Abraham, leave your home that you know to go to this land that you don't know. And then I'm going to give you a son when you're really old, but you have to wait more. And then now he has that son. What does he send him to go do? Go sacrifice your son for me. God sends Moses to go face, in Exodus, the man with the most power in the world at the time, Pharaoh, and demand that the people be released from slavery. God sends his people into the wilderness for 40 years because their hearts do not understand who he is. And so in their rebellion, he needs them to be in the wilderness. You know, sometimes, and I don't know if it's like a Southern Christian thing, but you can hear the language of praying a hedge of protection, which I get and makes sense. But what do we read in Job as we're reading it in community Bible reading? In Job 1, God brings the hedge down. He offers Job up to Satan because of how much faith Job has. God sends his people into hardship. What was God the Father's favorite person is who? God the Son. And what was Jesus' life prosperous plan? To bear the weight of sin, being crucified on a cross as a criminal. That was his prosperous plan that God sends him into. And so in the gospel, Jesus is not just this amazing teacher that teaches in a way that no one had ever heard. But what did John the Baptist say when he saw him in John 1? There's the Lamb who comes to take away the sin of the world. Jesus came to be a sacrifice. And so if you're a follower of Jesus, the same is true of you. He sends you into hardship for your good, for my good. In James 1, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. In Psalm 139, maybe the most intimate psalm where God knows who we are so deeply, it says this, your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed, were crafted for me, when as yet there was none of them. Ephesians 2:10, he has created us for good works that he prepared beforehand. He sends you and I every day into hardship for our good, so that we will be exposed and that we will know him. Charles Spurgeon, he was a English pastor in the 19th century. He said this about this passage: "Do not consider the adverse circumstances are a proof that you have missed your road, for they may even be an evidence that you are in the good old way, since the path of believers is seldom without trial. You did well to embark and to leave the shore, but remember, though your Lord has insured the vessel and guaranteed that you shall reach your haven, he has not promised that you shall sail over a sea of glass. On the contrary, he has told you that in the world you shall have tribulation, and you may all the more confidently believe in him because you find his warning to be true." So where are you being sent right now so that you can know him? And it's in your marriage, it's in your friendship, it's in how you parent, it's in your work, it's how you face sickness, it's the death of a loved one. Where has he sent you? And it has exposed you. And the easy work is to think it's all random. The easy work is to think that your life events are scattered and things just happen. The gritty work, the fun work, is to be on the lookout for God. What is he doing? To be a reflective person. How is he moving and acting in my life for my good? If God is sovereign, as the Bible talks about, if he's in control, then he's doing a great job working all things to accomplish his design. And that includes the hardships, the relationships, the struggles we face so that we would know him. And so that we would be left being in awe. And we'd be full of wonder at how great he is and where he is sending us. So he sends out the disciples so that they will know him. But we will see how they are exposed in working without Jesus. This moves us to our second point. Often, just like the disciples, we are earthy. What do I mean by that? Our solutions are earthy. Our thinking is earthy. We think we know. We think we have the answers. We think we can solve. We got it. We're independent. And then it fails, but we don't cry out. And instead, we're filled with worry and anxiety and despair. And so the disciples are exposed in this, and they have a disposition of fear rather than faith. So a few places in this passage where they are exposed by Jesus sending them out is, number one, their weakness and frailty going against the wind. They get tired, and they are weak as they are working, just sailing. In verse 51, it says this, "And he got into the boat And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded." Now, utterly astounded, you might read that and think, wow, that's really cool. They're like, amazed, look at that miracle. No, that's not what it means. It means they're driven out of their minds in insanity. They are confused and baffled, and they don't know what they're doing. And then the last verse, so baffling, is their hearts are hardened as they reflect on the miracle of the 5,000 and what they just saw. So the people closest to Jesus, who have a front row seat, are watching all of these amazing things. Their heart is getting smaller and colder the longer they're with Jesus. That makes no sense. But their solutions are earthy. Their thinking is earthy. They don't know who he is. And so this is where they are left. Have you ever watched something and you completely got it backwards? You know, sometimes if you're like really excited about a movie or a show and you bring in, you know, a spouse or a friend, you're like, this is going to, you know, your life's about to change because it changed my life. And they start watching and they have all these questions and they're not enjoying it to the level in which you are enjoying it. And now you hate them because they don't see the beauty in what you're trying to lead them to. Right? They're missing it. Or I remember when I was young, my dad watched golf and I thought that was so like the worst thing you could ever watch on TV. And now I like it. So I guess I'm aging. But so I used to be so confused why the guy with the least amount of points won. Because, you know, in my mind, I was like, no, it's the most points that win. Why? It just made no sense. I completely missed the point of what was trying to be accomplished. And so we can say that that's what's happening here. The disciples are missing the point. They're getting it backwards. They're misreading. And because they're misreading the situation, it's leading to dangerous implications. Like going back for the three ways they were exposed, in their exhaustion, as they're fighting against the wind, do they cry out? Do they pray? No, they just keep fighting. We're going to get past this wind. And they just keep going. Or the second way, when they're terrified, they see their best friend, their master, come into the boat and calm the storm, and it does not bring comfort to their hearts. Right? It doesn't excite them that he's here with them. Or the last way, when they reflect on the whole feeding of the 5,000, the loaves, it does not lead to a revelation that God is with them, that something amazing is happening. They are missing the point. They are misreading the whole thing. And so they have chosen, and they're deciding to live in their natural broken way of choosing fear over faith. That's the natural thing, to bend to fear. And this is important, though. Fear is the appropriate response to a life without God. Absolutely. A life without God, fear is the correct response. If you are someone, if you have anxiety and worry and you don't have God, that is exactly what you should feel. If you're in this room and you're not a Christian or you're contemplating, that is something you have to figure out in yourself when you are faced with something that is out of your control. When life is hard, fear and worry and despair are the correct feelings. That is, should be what you, the conclusion you come to. Because it should be the normalcy of how problems affect us if we have a life without the Lord. But those of us who follow Jesus, we still come to those conclusions so often because we are thinking earthy. We view earthy. We do not look up. We do not reflect. What is God up to? What is he doing? And so where have you been sent that you are misreading the situation? Where you have a difficult family, a lost loved one, depression, you know, the grind of your life. Where is it for you where you are misreading the situation? Where instead of whatever you're facing, wherever you're being sent, it's not driving you into deeper prayer. It's not driving you to wrestle with God what you're facing. It doesn't drive you into intimacy, but instead it's making you grow cold. And you're quick to anger, and you're quick to spew out hate. And that you're exhausted because why? It's all on you. You feel like it's all on you. It's earthy. You know, doing student ministry, often we as parents, we think sometimes being a helicopter parent is going to make our kid become good. Whatever good is for you and successful, if I can just control and, you know, help them make these decisions and force them to do this, then they'll become what I want them to be. Right? Helicopter parenting takes no faith. It takes no faith because you are trying to control and make it happen. Or when your life gets hard, you have more control, our instinct to have more control. Or the opposite, when life gets so overwhelming, what do we go into? Maybe more self-pity. And it's just the pride of how hard my life is, and I want others to feel how hard my life is. I mean, there's nothing, it might sound more spiritual. There's nothing spiritual in that. Because either direction, there's no faith in that. There's no watching the Lord in that. There's no crying out to him in that. And that's what he's after. He is after us knowing him. And so if you're not a Christian this morning, the Bible kind of paints this picture of what is ultimately our sin against God. And it's living like this. It's living like we are the king and queen of our own life to reign and rule. And we're going to make it happen. And we make our own decisions. And we know what's best for us. And also at the same time, enjoying different things this world and not giving him any thanks. Abusing the things down here without giving him any of the recognition. And so even as we live like that, like the disciples, not looking to the Lord, not crying out to him, not being in awe and amazement at Jesus, Jesus is still after us. Period. He still wants us to know him. Like last week, you know, Tim talked about Jesus as the shepherd. He's a shepherd. He looks at a crowd and they're harassed and helpless. And he says they're like sheep without a shepherd. He loves to guide scattered people. He loves to be intimate with his sheep that don't know their way. And so it is his compassionate heart that drives him into people like us so we can wake up. And we can see him and behold him and be in love and then follow him. And he is after us. He pursues. And so if this is describing you this morning, and if you're like the man, if you're not looking to him and you're just looking earthy and you're trying to just solve your own problems and it's all on you, or wherever you are in that, and you like the man or woman you're becoming, keep ignoring the Lord. But if you're exhausted by that, and it's tiring, and you feel that joy just slipping farther and farther away from you, there is a better way. There is a great hope. And so let's turn our attention to what it's like to have Jesus. It's hard to see on the outset, but Mark, in a lot of places, but especially today in our passage, it's covered with Exodus language. And so Exodus, the second book of the Old Testament, God redeeming his people. They were slaves 400 years in Egypt. He brings them out. He's going to take them to the promised land. That story, he delivers them through the 10 plagues. Amazing. In Exodus 33, we see this really weird interaction between God and Moses. Moses is asking the Lord, show me your glory. I just want to see your glory. And God's like, Moses, if you see my face, you'll die. No man can see my face. But if you break this rock, right, I'll cover your eyes, and as I walk by, I'll remove my hand so you can see my backside. And so Moses sees the glory of God walk by as he's looking through the cleft of this rock. It's a really odd interaction. But that's the language we actually see in this passage. So look at verse 48. And he, being Jesus, saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against him. And about the fourth watch of the night, so that's between 3 and 6 a.m., he came to them walking by the sea. He meant to pass by them. And so, you know, sometimes you might read that before and think Jesus actually was trying to, like, get around the boat and meet him at the destination, but that's not what's happening. He meant to pass by them, hoping that as they don't understand who he is, as they're confused by this whole thing, that as they're struggling, they might see his glory pass by. It's the same language. But instead, they do not. They cry out because they think it's a ghost. And so verse 49, but they saw him walking on the sea, and they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him, and they were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, take heart, it is I. And so just like in Exodus 2, where God hears the groans and cries of his people, and then it leads him to go care for them, Jesus sees them struggling, and, you know, he just takes a nice evening walk against the wind to catch up to all these men rowing a boat. I asked my 5-year-old daughter, like, I told her, like, hey, we're talking about this story, you know, what should I say? Her name's Daisy. I was like, Daisy, what should I say? And she said, tell them he's like a swan with two legs. I was like, okay, so Jesus was like a swan with two legs just catching up to them. And then they're terrified. They scream. They don't understand. They think it's a ghost. Then he calms the storm again, and he gets into the boat, and he says this, take heart, it is I, Exodus 3. When God was revealing himself to Moses in the burning bush, it is Yahweh, I am what I am. That is what Jesus is saying right here. He's trying to comfort these disciples who are terrified, who are worried, by saying, Yahweh's with you. Don't be afraid. Take courage. The best possible case scenario is right here with you. Yahweh. But the presence of Yahweh does not bring them comfort. They're utterly astounded. They're driven out of their minds in confusion. They're going insane. They do not understand. The presence of God is the greatest thing we can have, or is the greatest curse. Because the Bible tells this story that one day all of us will be before God. And what excuse will we have on that day to defend our sin? To defend what we've done? With how we've sinned against him, how we've hurt each other, whatever it is, what are you going to say? And the gospel, the great truth about the Christian faith, is it's either your sin is on you or your sin is on Jesus. Someone is atoning for that sin. Someone is going to pay, because God is so good, he has to punish evil. Someone is going to pay for that sin. And so now, if your faith's in Christ, what it says is because the Father turns his face away from Jesus so that we could be brought into the presence of God. And so on that day, you and I aren't going to face judgment and punishment. We're going to face the warmth of a father. who welcomes us in to his kingdom as sons and daughters. The presence of God will be the greatest thing we enjoy. It is the greatest thing we can have. And so when we know that, we're like the psalmist in Psalm 32. Blessed, and blessed in the Psalms are often happy, the purest form of happy. Happy is the one whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. That is what we feel when we see Jesus. We're blessed. You can't get a better deal than that. And so just like in the assurance of pardon, in the gospel, what do we have? We don't just see the backside of God walking by. We see his face. God's in the boat with them. You can't get closer than that. And the assurance of pardon, let the light shine out of darkness, has shone into our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. God himself has come to dwell and save his people. He's right there. And so it's this Jesus that the disciples can't figure out, but Jesus will continue to teach them and be patient with them. It's this Jesus that will deliver himself to be arrested. It's this Jesus that will be crucified and treated as a criminal, though he was innocent. And it is this Jesus that will defeat death. And so the disciples now are hard-hearted and cold toward Jesus because they don't understand. But it's these same knuckleheads that are going to become the ones that die as martyrs with smiles on their faces. Why? They saw their king, their master, their friend defeat death. They saw him. You can't stop them now. They have God's presence always. They are unstoppable. And so if this is true, then we should not be like the disciples here that are led into great confusion when we encounter Jesus, but instead we should be men and women who take heart and have courage, that we're not afraid because we are being sent by Jesus and he is with us. In high school, I played basketball, and my coach was amazing and terrifying. And he often said words at a loud volume, and sometimes there was four letters. Oftentimes there was four letters, and so he was a terrifying guy. And I lived thinking he was everywhere, and I lived thinking he could always see me, and that is a true thing. So at Plant City High School, kids like during lunch to sneak away because McDonald's was nearby, and I never left campus one time. I never skipped a class. Right? I never was tardy. Because I did some not good things off the school premises, and I would call him to tell him, like, the next day in case word got out. I mean, his presence controlled my decision making. There's this Christian idea called coram Deo, before the sight of God. And it's this idea that we live every moment knowing we are living right before him. If that's true, you and I have never been alone one day in our life. You've never been alone. And it's living, R.C. Sproul says it like this. He says, to live in the presence of God is to understand that whatever we are doing, wherever we are doing it, we are acting under the gaze of God. God is omnipresent. There is no place so remote that we cannot escape his penetrating gaze. And so this is how the most real way we could live is living knowing he's right there. And so the Bible often has a little picture that kind of grows bigger over time. And so you can think of it like, an acorn has the oak tree, right? But it's not the oak tree yet. This world is the acorn. And a more real world is coming. Your life, the most real way, you can think, God's, aloof or something. But the most real way we can live is knowing he's right there. And live in light of that with joy. Let that determine what we do and what we say. Because we have his presence that Jesus purchased. And so if you're a follower of Jesus, he is present, he is near, he is watching right now. Right now. And so as we are exposed by the different trials we go through, wherever we are sent, we can with joy and with confidence be needy to him, go to him, cling to him, cry out to him, because he is near. And we can take heart and be of great courage. So three quick application from this passage. Number one, you and I have never been good at anything we did not lean into. You've never been good at anything that you did not lean into wanting to get better at. And that is the same with faith. We cannot know God intimately. We can't know his presence without knowing him. And what we believe is he has spoken through a book. Know this book. Devour this book. Read this book with friends. Ask questions of this book. But know this book because it leads you to knowing him. Second, it is God's presence in our life over a long period of time that transforms us. It's his presence. And if that is true, we now get to imitate that with our friends in this city. Trinity is called to love Lakeland. You are called to love the people in your life. Be present with them. Sit with them. Talk with them. Get them to know Jesus. But it's your presence with them. And lastly, Jesus sends us into hardship so we would know him. And so he sends us into facing death, sickness, relational tension, tough children, you name it, whatever it is. Wrestle with him. Plead with him. Complain to him. Pray to him. Be thankful to him. Go to him with everything. Don't let your heart grow cold as you just go away from him. Lean into him. His ear is bent toward his children. He wants to hear from us. Go to him. So wherever you are, whatever you are facing, take heart and have courage because God is with you. The Father turned away from the Son so we could be brought into the presence of God forever. You cannot get better news than that. He is with you. Will you pray with me? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, thank you for how you expose us. You expose us through trials. You expose us through relationships. You expose us through people. It's amazing that you are so committed to us that you will expose us so that we will be driven into greater need. And I pray that our neediness would drive us to you who has everything. You who love us first. You come after us. You've redeemed us. You've saved us. You have made us new. Help us to be men and women of faith. That fear, anxiety, and worry would just be great slingshots into faith. We need you. Help us to live knowing you are near and present. It's in Jesus' name. Amen.